Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Ellen Frank, PhD artist and creator of the Cities of Peace program, who has just unveiled the new gold leaf painting commemorating the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Shinshinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy, and our Mavena on Israel, Imbal Stevie. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. In the synagogue readings cycle, we are now in the section of the Torah in which we read of the plagues inflicted on the Egyptians in order to free our ancestors from slavery. Those ancient plagues, taking place in an African setting over 3,200 years ago, form a kind of roster of disasters that could strike and undermine or even destroy an ancient civilization. Water shortage, amphibian and insect infestations, wild animal attacks, livestock infections, disease pandemics, destructive weather, eclipses, inexplicable deaths. In the Torah, these divinely directed disasters destroy Egypt's productive capacity and fracture their faith in their own gods. But this amazing story took place a very, very long time ago. What are the contemporary equivalents of the plagues that overturned Egypt so long ago? Various Jewish organizations have come up with 10 modern or contemporary plagues to parallel the 10 listed in the Book of Exodus. These range from 10 plagues based on environmental issues, to 10 plagues caused by poverty and economic inequality, to 10 plagues of modern slavery, 10 plagues of psychological and emotional trauma, and so on. And while these are effective ways of bringing attention to areas of our world that need commitment and change, I actually think the original 10 plagues themselves serve as a better model for highlighting areas of the world that desperately need attention now. For example, the Nile River turning to blood vividly illustrates the increasingly dire issue of the lack of safe drinking water in many parts of the world, most acutely in Africa. The invasions of animal and insect pests remind us of the unsafe and unsanitary conditions of many people in the world, both here at home in America and in nations like India and Bangladesh. The wild beasts of the Bible are perhaps better exemplified by the brutal humans today who prey on others. Terrorists, those inflamed by racist ideologies and extreme beliefs, who commit acts of violence against innocents. Predator humans who engage in human trafficking. The storms of hail can inspire us to respond to the cataclysmic dangers of global warming and our own urgent need to change the path our species is on before we destroy our own planet. The threat of pandemics and inexplicable deaths calls to mind the various disease epidemics that have arisen suddenly in recent years. The current Chinese disease, the coronavirus, killing people right now. Ebola, AIDS, others. They might also remind us that our own American healthcare system is in spectacular and inequitable disarray, financially out of control, consuming greater and greater portions of our national wealth, and under the malign control of insurance companies that deny care and healing to many. And the plague of darkness should enlighten us to the terrible danger that the darkness of ignorance, illiteracy, and deliberate falsehood present. How that darkness threatens our very ability to create societies based on trust, honesty, and peace. In some ways, like Pharaoh, the tyrants of today still ignore and sometimes even exploit the plagues that afflict our world. And it is our responsibility, as it was Moses's, to call them out, to refuse to accept that contemporary plagues are acceptable conditions. Plagues today can only be remedied by our own actions. And true freedom comes when we are able to share it with everyone. On a more positive note, to play us in this morning, we have the wonderful duo Yonina singing a setting of Rachel's beautiful Hebrew poem, Lamdeni. Teach me, God, a blessing and a prayer on the flower, on ripened fruit, so that today won't be just the same as yesterday.
Lamdeni Elohai barech ve'itpalel al soda lekamel al noga pri basher al acherut azot lirot lachush linshom ladat leyachel leikasher Lamdeni Elohai barech ve'itpalel al soda lekamel על נוגע פרי בשם על החירות הזאת לראות לחוש לנשום לדעת ליחד להיקשר למד את צבתותי רוחה ושיר הלב להתחדש זמן חיים בוקר ועם לב לבל יהיה יומי היום כתמול שירשום למד את צבתותי ברכה ושיר הלב והתחדש זמן חיים בוקר ועם לב לבל יהיה על היומי
That was Yonina, who began their performing career recording YouTube videos in their Israeli living room and have since become very popular Israeli and Jewish music stars, singing Lamdeni. Our guest this morning, Ellen Frank, is an artist, a PhD professor, and the founder of Cities of Peace, a remarkable nonprofit that develops gold leaf artworks advocating peace in cities that have been traumatized by war. Her latest work is being unveiled right now in time for the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, and it involved many participants from many countries in its creation. Hear about this remarkable project when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish Art guests this morning. Ellen Frank is an artist, scholar, and author, has won many awards in painting, book design, and scholarship, a variety of fellowships, endowments, and grants, but most importantly for us right now, she is created as part of the Cities of Peace project, which is really her project, a remarkable installation that's going in right now into Krakow, Poland, in time for the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish, Dr. Frank.
Thank you so much, and please call me Ellen.
Okay. Tell us where the Cities of Peace project came from, and then talk a little bit about your involvement.
So I gave birth, as it were, to the Cities of Peace project. Now it started with Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is titled Jerusalem, a Painting Toward Peace, and that grew up after my first trip to Jerusalem. So Cities of Peace was born in 2004-2005, and it grew very quickly to being an entire concept and a body of work that has included young people and scholars and artists from 33 countries now working alongside us to honor the history and culture of world cities that have suffered trauma.
And, you know, of course, Jerusalem literally means City of Peace, so a great place to begin. Krakow is the nearest city to Auschwitz-Birkenau and has a remarkable, revived, extraordinary Jewish community now, but of course it's almost the epicenter of the Holocaust in some ways. Tell us about how you developed the installation you're working on now, the piece of art.
So it's quite a place to work. It's powerful, and this piece is it's a creation of a new Cities of Peace painting. It's called Turnings, Sparking Light, and it's done in collaboration with Polish artists and actually visitors from dozens of countries who've passed through the museum, each person putting a golden mark on the painting. So it's a monumental painting. It's really all Holocaust memorial painting, but there's something totally new about it, and that's that it's all gold, and it does not show sorrow, horror, anguish, suffering. This painting has a lamed. It has two roses, the symbolic, mystical 13-petaled rose. It has a pattern of the ceiling of Temple Synagogue in Krakow. And it's done working side by side, strangers working side by side with each other, doing an illuminated painting.
Let's talk more in the later part of the show about how these collaborations occur and how you develop that concept when we return in a moment with Ellen Frank here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, new classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha has moved to larger quarters in our new synagogue, 2270 West Ina Road, Suite 100, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us Friday night at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our new synagogue is at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina. Just at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property, we are not in the mall, but on the south side in our own building, and we'll be there for a while. Join us at 2270 West Ina, west of La Cholla on the north side. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, new ones start this week. And of course, all of our services, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's www.BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or call 276-5675. That's 520-276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the newest and fastest-growing Jewish community in all of Southern Arizona at its exciting beginning. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So Americans are now getting used to something they didn't have to deal with very much before, which is a level of security at Jewish institutions, particularly synagogues, that has existed all around the world for a very long time, but we ain't used to that here. Some thoughts about that.
Well, first of all, there's a small irony in using the word security, because what you really mean is a level of insecurity that we never had before.
That's right.
People are scared. There have been countless incidents of violent anti-Semitism in the past couple of years. And one might ask, what's behind this? What caused this steep increase? And one might also ask, what's the best response? So a couple of thoughts. First of all, in Europe for many, many years, synagogues were like armed camps. As a tourist, usually you needed to fax your passport 48 hours in advance of any intended service attendance.
Going to Shabbat or Friday night, right. Saturday morning, you had to let them know way in advance.
And they probably did some kind of rudimentary security check, or at least your name was on a list and they knew who you were and they had records, whatever.
And then once you got there, of course, there'd be a couple of layers of people checking you and so often a metal detector.
Well, but that also depends on which country and which community. The first place I noticed this actually was Zurich, which you think of as a very safe, quiet place where nothing violent ever happens. It's Switzerland, after all. And that, I must say, is probably close to 50 years ago. When I was working for the World Union of Jewish Students, I was in Zurich a lot for one reason or another. And also Geneva, same deal there. So one of the interesting things is that, again, depending on the country and the community, this added level of security is often provided by the national government or the local government, or government at some level assumes the responsibility to keep Jews safe while they are in their houses of worship. And so they pay the enormous expense involved in having all these people and equipment and radios and walkie-talkies, and they see that as part of their duties. Here, it's not quite so clear-cut. First of all, we have governments on so many levels that define their roles so differently, and those definitions change from year to year. We have federal, we have state, we have county, we have municipal. I mean, even here in Tucson, you could have protection offered by some federal agency like the FBI. You could have state police. You could have county cops. You could have local law enforcement officers,
city municipalities,
or you could have hired contractors. And that really depends on who's footing the bill. And it's an interesting question to ask. Well, we all sort of know why there's been this uptick in violent anti-Semitism in the U.S., but it's an interesting question to ask, what can we do about it? And I think maybe we should address that next week.
Thanks, Tom. We will do so.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our shlicha, Inbal Shtivi, head of the Weintraub Israel Center, representing Israel. Boker Tov.
Boker Ol. I represent the Israeli society.
You're representing all of the country, the nation, state of Israel throughout its history, the society, the culture, everything. The whole civilization.
Oh my God.
So speaking of civilization, one of the really great Israeli TV shows that's come over and achieved wide popularity in the United States is Shtisel.
Yes.
And the co-creator of Shtisel is going to be right here. And I think it brings up a really fascinating question, Yonatan Endursky, about the relationship between the Haredi community, the state, the Chiloni, the ultra-Orthodox community, and the complexity of the community itself.
We're blessed to have Endursky come over and talk about a little bit his creation, his cinematic and television creations. He was a former student at the Fonny Baz Yeshiva. You could talk to him more about it. But generally,
he left ultra-Orthodoxy and became a filmmaker. But that, of course, it deeply informs his work. There's no way to explain it.
Of course, I think everything he did so far was related to that. The life experience of being a part of the Haredi community is very unique. It's not a regular Israeli life cycle.
You're not going to the beach on Saturday.
No, you're going to the beach on other days,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, they have specific days, and men and women go different days.
They go actually. Different days,
different
yeah.
Different parts of the beach, it's really
the halachic rules are pretty much controlling the way of life within the Haredi community. And when I say Haredi community, it's a big word. There are so many different Haredi communities within Israel and within Jerusalem specifically, and not only there. Yeah, they make up and quite a big percent of the Israeli society.
You know, and I think Americans think that everybody in Israel is Orthodox, and that percentage used to be quoted as 15 to 20%. It's probably 25% now. I'd
yeah,
guess.
And this community has larger birth rates.
Yeah, tremendous birth rates. Right?
Yeah, compared to non-Orthodox and Chiloni. Jewish people in Israel. So anyway, it is important to understand that Haredi communities are extremely separated. They do not go to the same schools as state schools. They do not, some of them don't learn basic English, mathematics, and other core education
skills.
Yeah.
Right.
Some of them are, it's extremely complex. The relations between the different Haredi communities is complex, and the relation between the Haredi communities themselves with the states are complex. There are Ashkenazim, there are Sephardim, there are Fonibaj, and there are Gur, and there are so many others. Walking through Meh Shearim and other neighborhoods.
Neighborhood in Jerusalem, yeah. Of course. Or Bnei Brak, for example.
Or Bnei Brak.
Right.
Is a major cultural experience, and there are and there are many. Of course, the state in itself wants to advance this community. There has been many programs to advance integration, labor force integration for women, for men. It's a major debate in Israel all the time on what and how to do, because they are part of us,
part of the state, part of the Jewish people.
They are part of the Jewish people. They're
but
part
often
of yeah.
not part of the same economy, even in Israel, and not necessarily part of the same educational process that leads to such a successful country.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting and complicated challenge. Well,
it is.
We will we'll talk about this again, I expect. Thanks so much, Inval.
Thank you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Schwartz is sitting in his room wearing only a top hat when Steinberg strolls in. "Why are you sitting here naked?" he asks. "It's all right," says Schwartz. "Nobody comes to visit." "But why the hat?" And Schwartz says, "Maybe somebody will come." I love that joke. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well, and just in case, wear a hat. We welcome our Shin Shinim, our young representatives of Israel, Daniel Levy and Shai Friedwald. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So Israeli TV is like the hottest thing on Netflix and Amazon
right.
Prime. It seems like there's so... It used to be if there was an Israeli show, it might be a movie or something, mm-hmm. or it was inspired people in America to make a show based on it, like there was a counseling show that came over. But now between... well, you can talk about Olam HaFauda and Shtisel and Srugim and all of these shows that people are binge-watching. It's really startling.
Right. So I think... that all of those shows are streaming in different countries in the world are so interesting for them because their story is so good and based on a deep content, and they have rich characteristics, actors and theme and all of the criterias for the show. And the most unbelievable thing is that most of those shows based on our reality. So our reality is strong enough, is deep enough, so it can be so different countries around the world can be interested in. But the other thing that when they watch news and they hear a lot of different things about Israel, so they hear the opposite things than they see at those TV shows, which are like conflicted between each other. Because here you see our reality, but then on the news you see lies. So they
or
don't
you
know.
See, you know, it's violent. They're oppressive.
Right. So most of the times they believe. To the news.
Let's get a little specific. You know, for example, Fauda, which has become widely popular, which is a great show.
It is.
And it is about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I mean, you know, it's about Israelis. Those who haven't watched it, you should. But don't watch it right before you go to sleep, because it's a very intense show. It's about an Israeli unit that goes in and tries to prevent terrorist attacks on Israel in the West Bank, even in Gaza.
I feel like those shows, like Fada, for example, I mean, some people might say, okay, this is a TV show, those are actors. But what people don't realize is that this is just showing the hidden face, or like the unspoken about Israel. It's about Fada.
Well,
about,
the guys that made Fada were in that unit.
And
they know what they're
reality.
Talking about.
That's how we get our information. We send people in the enemy's territory. They gather up information. Another show that has been also released in the United States is called When Heroes Fly.
Right.
It's about
a
group of Israelis that suffer from PTSD, which is something that no one really talks about. I mean, everyone assumes that every soldier goes for his service 2, 3, 4 years and just goes on with his life. But no, some people witness just some horrible things, and that is something that they show in this TV show. That there's also this unpretty side of doing the military service. You witness so much awful things, and it's just like doesn't let you really continue with your life because it's just very hard.
Sure. Yeah. No, I mean, I think what's fascinating about these Israeli shows is they're very open. They're very honest.
Yes. Like, we have nothing to hide. I mean, this is our reality. It's open for everyone.
It's a real society with real
stuff,
you know. Mm-hmm. And if you're watching Shtisel, people think it's about orthodoxy. It's really not. It's about human beings who happen to be ultra-orthodox, mm-hmm. and they're living their lives and trying to find love. You know, it's a very interesting show. And I think each of these has something to show. What it really shows is Israel's a very open democracy with a great video culture. I don't know what the right term for it, but it's attracting attention all over, not just America, all over the world. So if you don't have Netflix, you should get it. And you should stream these Israeli shows because they're really fantastic.
And make some free time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Stop watching.
In your copious spare time.
Yes.
Thanks so much, guys. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
Shabab.
And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Bo features the actual exodus from Egypt. The climactic text is very familiar from Passover seders and bad movies, but it is no less dramatic for its familiarity. Moses and Aaron warn Pharaoh that the final plague is coming. God tells the Israelites to sacrifice a lamb, put its blood on their doorpost to protect themselves from the coming calamity. At midnight, the angel of death visits the homes of every Egyptian. From Pharaoh on his throne to the prisoner in the dungeon, and the firstborn male son of every household dies. Even the livestock lose their firstborn. After long refusing freedom to the Israelites, after 10 plagues and every underhanded manipulation he could invent, Pharaoh finally gives up. He literally throws the Israelites out of Egypt, saying, "Get away from my people." But there's an ironic twist at the end of this freedom narrative in Bo. Even before the Pharaoh's fruitless quest to recapture the Israelites at the sea ends badly for the Egyptians in next week's portion of Bishalach, Pharaoh has already ordered Moses and Aaron to leave his land. But before they can go, he says, "Be gone, but bless me first." What a strange thing to say to your enemy, to whom you are now essentially surrendering. Get out now, but before you go, give me a blessing. There is pathos in this request, for Pharaoh has been an arrogant and magnificently stubborn opponent. Moses' request was for religious freedom for the Israelite slaves, 3 days to worship God in their own Hebrew fashion. Rejecting this simple plea, Pharaoh instead multiplied the slaves' work and reduced their supplies, increased their misery in the time-honored tradition of every union-busting tyrant in history. This combination of arrogance and egotism has now brought death to his country and to his family. Pharaoh's own eldest son, his designated successor, has died. And now he says to his antagonists, Moses and Aaron, bless me too. The Torah does not record Moses' response to this peculiar request. Does he offer a prayer to Pharaoh? If so, what is the suitable blessing for a brutal, genocidal God king? Was it a mourning prayer for his dead son? Or was it more like the rabbi and Fiddler on the Roof? May God bless and keep the Pharaoh far away from us. After 9 plagues worth of direct evidence, the overwhelming power of Moses' God has become clear, even to this human representative of Egypt's polytheistic gods, a man who may even believe himself divine. And in that surrender, a little bit of humanity from Pharaoh peeks through. My gods are discredited, my blessings and curses overthrown. In my mourning, in my confusion, in my despair, I need a blessing from my worst enemy. There's something peculiarly human about this, just as true today as over 3,000 years ago. Often in life, we seek blessing not from those who support us and agree with us, but from those who don't. We long for the respect, if not the love, of those who are hardest to please and least likely to accept us. Sometimes the approval or admiration of our enemies ranks higher in our estimation than the steady praise of our acolytes. As Jews, we know this strange motivation well. How often do we struggle with the need for approval from figures who do not give it easily, with the lack of unconditional parental love, the absence of regard from those from whom we most need it, the near desperate desire to be accepted? That is not to say that Pharaoh is a needy Jewish child or Moses an uncaring Jewish father. The Pharaoh of this story is an evil, megalomaniac tyrant. But apparently, megalomaniac tyrants have emotional needs too. Even in a warped person, the human need for parental approval remains. In a story filled with drama and power, that plaintive request, "Bless me too," adds a human note. We all need to find blessing. Pharaoh never does. He soon regrets his emotional weakening here in Bo and chases after the Israelites to further his own ruin, but perhaps we, who have done so much less wrong than Pharaoh, and who need blessing at least as much, will be able to find it in our own lives. When we return, our guest, Ellen Frank, artist, teacher, and organizer of the incredible Cities of Peace Project, speaks to us from Krakow, Poland, and will explain the newest artwork of the series, a gold leaf painting commemorating the liberation of Auschwitz, just in time for the 75th anniversary. She'll be here when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The World Holocaust Forum met in Jerusalem last week, bringing together leaders from all over the planet. Opening the event at the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial, Israel's President Reuven Rivlin warned that anti-Semitism and racism continue to be a malignant disease. While many world leaders speak and will speak, including Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, French President Emmanuel Macron, the Prince of Wales, that's his first official visit to Israel for Charles, by the way, the President of Germany and Vladimir Putin of Russia, Polish President Andrzej Duda refused to attend in protest at not being invited to speak, unlike his Russian counterpart Putin. He has accused Putin, accurately, of distorting the history of the Holocaust and the war to attack Poland. The Holocaust Forum commemorates the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau, worst and most notorious of all death camps, where 2 million people were murdered by the Nazis during their reign of terror in the Shoah. In a selfless and dramatic move, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and his delegation to the World Holocaust Forum gave up their seats at the main ceremony at Yad Vashem so that Holocaust survivors could have them. Zelensky, who is Jewish, heard that some survivors could not be accommodated at the opening ceremony at the Holocaust Memorial Center Auditorium, which seats only 800, After several Israeli Knesset ministers gave up their seats to survivors, Zelensky responded by having his entire delegation surrender their seats to Shoah survivors. German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier spoke compellingly, accepting full German responsibility for the Shoah and saying, "The spirits of evil today are emerging in a new guise, presenting their anti-Semitic, racist, authoritarian thinking as an answer for the future, a new solution to the problems of our age. I wish I could say that we Germans have learned from history once and for all, but I cannot say that when hatred is spreading. I cannot say that when Jewish children are spat on in the schoolyard. I cannot say that when crude anti-Semitism is cloaked in supposed criticism of Israeli policy. I cannot say that when only a thick wooden door prevents a right-wing terrorist from causing a bloodbath in a synagogue in the city of Halle on Yom Kippur. Of course, our age is a different age. The words are not the same. The perpetrators are not the same. But it is the same evil." And in other news, in a survey of 1,100 French adults, 57% of respondents indicated they did not know roughly how many Jews were murdered in the Holocaust. In the survey, which was commissioned by the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany in November and published last week, 30% of respondents put the figure at under 2 million. Misconceptions about the death toll were especially high among respondents younger than 38. Of those, 69% did not know that in reality 6 million Jews were murdered in the Holocaust, and 44% of the people in the entire survey thought it was lower than 2 million. Of the four countries surveyed by the group, French respondents displayed the highest level of ignorance on the topic, followed by Austrians, Canadians, and then Americans. In France, 44% of respondents said they had never heard of Auschwitz. Only 2% knew about Drancy, the main internment camp for French Jews. In the U.S. and Canada, only some states have added the Holocaust as a mandatory curriculum subject. It is mandatory in Austria and France. We will have Greg Schneider, head of the Claims Conference, which commissioned this report, as our guest here on Too Jewish next Sunday. Last week, Egypt began receiving natural gas from Israel, enacting a deal initially worth $15 billion that's part of Egypt's plan to become an energy re-export hub on Europe's doorstep. Israeli gas stocks rose quickly in response. This step represents an important development that serves the economic interests for both countries, Egypt's oil ministry said in a statement. Under the pact, Israeli gas will be processed at Egyptian liquefied natural gas factories before being exported to Europe. Israel's Delek Drilling LP, Noble Energy Inc., and Egyptian East Gas Company signed a deal in 2018 to buy control of the East Mediterranean Gas Company pipeline, connecting southern Israel to Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. It was initially built to export Egyptian gas to Israel. Now it's working the other way. In October, they agreed to increase gas flows by almost 35% more than the original figure, when they inked a 10-year deal valued at an additional $15 billion. This link was idle for about 6 years due to a domestic gas shortage in Egypt and repeated terrorist attacks on an overland stretch of Egypt's Sinai pipeline that has since been protected. The energy deal adds an economic factor to a relationship that's been focused on security since Israel and Egypt signed a peace treaty that changed the face of the Middle East 4 decades ago. Egypt also plans to use its own Zohr field to supply gas-hungry Europe. The pact is the result of strenuous work and a lot of determination and courage on the part of leaders on both sides, said Delek Drilling's chief executive officer, Yossi Abu. The gas agreement will strengthen the economy in Israel and in Egypt and strengthen the position of Israel and Egypt in the regional and global energy markets. Egypt will initially receive about 200 million standard cubic feet per day of gas, with supplies rising eventually to a daily 500 million sometime in 2020, Egyptian oil minister Tariq El Mola said.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. Since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
It snowed in northern Israel last week, and heavy winter rains raised the level of the Sea of Galilee, the Kinneret, within 2.5 feet of total capacity. You know, it wasn't long ago when the level of that beautiful lake was sinking faster and faster. but a variety of water measures taken by Israel, including the development of major desalination plants to supply drinking and irrigation water to the nation and resupply the lake, have reversed that trend. It's nice to hear good news in an environmental situation for a change, isn't it? And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Ellen Frank, artist, scholar, PhD, author, developer of the city, well, I guess the creator of the Cities of Peace project, which is now being exhibited and in a kind of a world premiere of the new painting on the city of Krakow related to, of course, Auschwitz-Birkenau and the 75th anniversary, which is taking place this coming week. And it's really a remarkable process. Can you describe, because in reading about the Cities of Peace program, when you began this, it was really an idea. And talk a little bit about, like, when you first started this, how it came about and how everybody just kind of jumped in to participate. Everybody may be wrong, but that's kind of how it feels.
That's just how it felt. So I, as I mentioned, the first painting was Jerusalem, a painting towards peace. And it was through my own suffering in Jerusalem with the tension and not knowing what that tension was. It was right before the Second Intifada broke out. And I realized I wanted to find non-military solutions to conflict. I wanted to find a way of really using art as a doorway to building a new kind of society and a new world. So Cities of Peace was born after meetings, actually, with one of the close associates of the Dalai Lama, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and they had charged the Nobel Peace Laureates with the question, what's necessary for world peace? And the answer the Nobel Laureates gave was, understanding is prerequisite to peace. So Cities of Peace is dedicated to understanding and compassion of world cities that have suffered trauma. So we opened our door. We just had a little tiny ad in Craigslist.
You said like a one-line ad in Craigslist, and suddenly people from 16, 17 countries showed up to help.
Absolutely. It was unbelievable. The first two were from Korea. The third was from Hong Kong. The fourth was from Colombia. The fifth was from Estonia. The sixth was from Honduras. They were desperate to first of all, work collaboratively. Secondly, work on a piece that they knew would be seen publicly by the world. And third, to have the opportunity to do something to help our world in its great suffering. So people slept on floors. Eight people shared one bathroom. It was extraordinary, and we created the first part of the collection of Cities of Peace in a tiny little painting studio outside of New York City.
How did you decide which cities to feature to do, besides Jerusalem as your beginning?
Well, my country was bombing Baghdad, and I needed to honor Baghdad, and my country was bombing Kabul, and I needed to honor Kabul. And what I learned was changed my life. I didn't know Baghdad was the greatest city on earth from 800 to 1200. I didn't know it was an experiment in governance and designed as a round city. I didn't know that their earliest creation myths before Noah, before Genesis.
Yeah, it was Gilgamesh or the Enuma Elish, both from that part of the world.
Yeah.
Sure.
I didn't know that. So those were necessities. Those first paintings were necessary, and it grew from there to build a world that honors these cities and says, "You're not my enemy. There is no enemy."
So a technical question. When I think of beautiful use of gold and illuminated paintings, I think of Klimt. How did you determine that as your medium? What attracted you to it?
The nature of light, and actually the great tradition of illuminated manuscripts. So the Book of Hours, the Book of Kells, and every major Abrahamic religion has created illuminated manuscripts.
Yeah, the Sarajevo Haggadah.
You know,
sure, I think of all of the great Jewish illuminated manuscripts, which are also in that family, as you said.
And we have the painting honoring Sarajevo has the words from the Sarajevo Haggadah in it, and it has images from it, and really was partly inspired, this painting, by it. 2 million books were incinerated during the war with Serbia. 2 million books and 1,500 illuminated manuscripts. And the Sarajevo Haggadah was protected by Muslims. It had been protected by Muslims during the Nazi occupation and again during the war.
How many people have participated in creating this Krakow painting? What's the right word for it?
It's an illuminated painting. Well, we've had hundreds of people put simple marks on it. So there are hundreds from Finland and Norway and Denmark and all the way to Turkey and Greece. And Germany, they've put marks of gold. In terms of the hardcore group artists.
That raises a very important question. How do you control that so they do it well?
We control it. So we do a kind of leapfrog. I don't know quite how you'd describe it. Every city we go to, I pull one or two of the artists from that city to go to the next city. So we had just been in Pristina, Kosovo, and Cities of Peace brought two young women artists, a Muslim and a Catholic, to Krakow. They were the first of their generation to bear witness at Auschwitz-Birkenau. And they're extraordinary human beings and talented. And they would guide the mark made by a visitor. Mm-hmm. So we would prepare a spot for the gold, and the visitor would be given the gold to put down and shown how to do it and have a feeling of joyous success in doing it.
You mentioned that there were a number of professional artists that worked on it. How many did you say?
The core group of professional artists was probably about 5 or 6. One who lives in Ostensum, Auschwitz, and who lives with this every day, this memory, and she drove into Krakow, and then 4 extraordinary artists who work day and night on this piece. So I would say at the hardcore is less than a dozen.
Less than a dozen.
Sort of between.
How long will this display be up? And it's in there's some remarkable Jewish converted synagogues that are museums in Krakow. How long will this be on display?
It'll be up through the 30th of March. And I must say, because I don't own these paintings, I must say that they are exquisite. That the talent and the collaborative capacity and the love and the purity of each work is breathtaking. My new assistant from Greece walked in and she said, "I knew they'd be beautiful, but I didn't know I would go, oh, wow." There, and the one honoring the liberation of Auschwitz is like, they're each unique, but this one is more unique, if I can say that.
You know, I'm looking at them online, which can't possibly be the same thing as seeing them in person. But they really are magnificent. Are they your designs? Is it a collaborative design? Can you explore that a little bit?
Well, as the artistic director, I do have final say, and in many cases they proceed from a vision I've had. And then that I share that vision, and then that vision gets added to or subtracted from or complemented. So, for instance, the liberation piece has the ceiling pattern of Temple Synagogue in Krakow. Well, one of our Kosovar artists said, Ellen, let's turn the pattern sideways. And when you turn it sideways, the star that looks like a six-pointed star on its side becomes the Star of David. So collaboration is, oh, let's do this. Oh, let's try that. So the collaboration is at every stage, every step of the way. And it's remarkable. Just yesterday, one of the artists put little medallions. It shows the night sky, January 27th, 1945, the day of the liberation. It's been reconstructed by astronomers, and it shows lines of the constellation as raised red gold. And I said, let's try this medallion in one spot. Well, it was like a star becomes a gilded, detailed medallion, suddenly dotting the painting. So there's one in the middle. We have a lamed in the middle of the painting, the mystical 13-petaled rose above and below. And the lamed is filled with the rose hip to suggest that even in the darkest of winters, there's nourishment there for the rose, the community of Israel, the people, the community of Jews around the world. And she put the medallion in one part of the painting, and I said, let's put it in the rose. And now one is in the rose, and it radiates the constellation up through the lamed to a star-studded sky that's all gold.
Where can people go to find out more about Cities of Peace?
So there are two different websites. There's www.citiesofpeace.org, and there's also the initials of the organization. So it's E for Ellen, F for Frank, I for Illumination, A for Arts, F for Foundation. So it's EFIAF.org. So both of those websites, or just Google Cities of Peace and add my name and you'll see it. And certainly go visit Galicia Jewish Museum and you'll see it there. And you know, write to me, please. Call me, write to me, WhatsApp me.
Call, write, email, text, all the above.
Ellen, thank you so much. I appreciate the wonderful work you're doing and continued success with this amazing project.
Thank you. This has been a joy and an honor. So thank you so much.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Greg Schneider, head of the Claims Conference, discussing the new study on knowledge of the Holocaust and ignorance of it in France. Our playout this morning comes from a great Israeli singer-songwriter, Meir Ariel, more famous posthumously than in his life, and his endearing song, Avarnu et Paro Na'avor Gam et Zeh. We survived Pharaoh, we can survive this too. Taxes, electronic failures, daily disasters. We survive Pharaoh, we can survive this too. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov and a week, we pray, of peace.
Masach nasa, hem iklu li magber. Maserach musak, hem iklu li mashder. Chevrat hachashmal, iklu li matzber. Minhal amayim, satmu li be'er. Raiti she'ani מתדרדר למשבר התחלתי הוסר אבל עברנו את פרעות נעבור גם את זה.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.